The steamboat people thought Captain Scott's ugly little riverboat was the best joke they'd seen in a long time. You know, he'd come to them asking for a job, and they laughed him off, so he built this boat on a shoestring budget. Ugliest thing you've ever seen, so ugly that nobody ever took a picture of it, as far as I can tell. I don't know what it looked like, other than ugly. But he sure had the last laugh, and he cut those cocky guys down to size. And I'm going to tell you all about it in just a minute. First, let me introduce myself. My name is Finn J.D. John, and I write a weekly newspaper column that runs in about a dozen papers around the state right now called Offbeat Oregon History. I've been writing it since 2008, so right now there are about 175 published episodes in the kitty. So every morning I pull one of those episodes up and put it out on the daily RSS feeds. One in text and pictures for your newsreader, and one in audio only for your podcatcher. Offbeat Oregon History tells the stories of Oregon history that nobody knows about, the ones everyone has forgotten. Stories of heroes and rascals, of shipwrecks and lost gold, of Shanghai sailors and Skid Row bordellos and pirates and robbers and buried treasure and unsolved mysteries. Today's episode was published first in the newspapers on October 21st, 2011. I'm going to read it to you now. In the summer of 1874, the executives of Oregon's two big steamboat companies were watching Uriah B. Scott's progress on the riverboat he was building. Watching and laughing. They were probably also congratulating themselves on not having hired him when he'd come to them, newly arrived in Oregon, asking for a job and babbling on about shallow draft hulls. They'd turned him down, of course. And now the poor naive fool was apparently planning to go into competition with them. What the other riverboat men were seeing wasn't exactly making them quake with fear. The scow Scott was building was an ugly little thing, like a shoebox with a smokestack sticking out the top and a homemade stern wheel hanging out over the back. It didn't look much like a boat, either. Its hull was wide and flat, not deep and curvaceous like the hulls of the other steamers on the river. The five men who had lent Scott $3,000 to build this mousetrap became objects of pity among the steamboat men of the two big firms, the Oregon Steam Navigation Company and the People's Transportation Company. The company men were confident that Scott's backers would never see their money again, and they weren't afraid to tell them so. Scott didn't mind. He knew his boat, which he'd dubbed the Ohio, was ugly. He didn't have enough money to make it pretty. He'd lost almost everything in a bank panic the previous year, which was why he'd left the Midwest and come to Oregon in the first place. No, he hadn't built the Ohio for looks. They'd see what he was up to when he got it in the water. In the meantime, the other steamboat companies weren't losing any sleep over the upstart. The bigger of the two, Oregon Steamship and Navigation Company, was a bloated and arrogant monopoly that had achieved total dominion over the Columbia River, largely by buying out everything in sight. Like many such firms, it took comfort in its bigness and didn't regard its inflated ticket prices and haphazard service as a serious problem. The People's Transportation Company, as its populist-sounding name suggests, was originally a scrappy upstart steamboat line created to challenge this monopoly and to tap into the frustration of the traveling public. But after a few successful years, it lost that competitive fire and made a cozy deal with OS&N, which basically gave each company a monopoly on one of the two rivers, Peoples on the Willamette and OS&N on the Columbia. With this arrangement in place, Peoples had settled in as a sort of junior monopoly, and both companies worked to avoid any kind of profit-killing competition on their routes, jacking their rates up back again to the nice old comfortable monopoly rates. Thus, neither major riverboat company had much of an interest in improvements to service unless they wouldn't cost money to implement. After all, they already had all the business on the river. Building a new shallow draft boat, like Scott had suggested, would cost money without generating any new income, so why should they be interested? The Willamette Valley farmers, however, were very interested. The People's Transportation Company steamboats couldn't get far enough the river to pick up their crops until deep into the rainy season, when the river levels were quite high. By that time, unless the grain was very carefully stored, the valley's famous fogs had often soaked it and opened the door for molds and mildew to ruin it. There was most definitely a market for the boats that Scott was talking about, and Scott knew it. It was that market that the Ohio was designed to fill. Soon the Ohio's launch day arrived, and crowds of steamboatmen came to look and laugh. Not only was the Ohio ugly, it had certain features that seemed distinctly under-engineered. Scott, watching every dime, had used steel gas pipes for the steam engine's connecting rods, or pitmans. And then there was that homemade paddle wheel. It was the kind of creation that, if duct tape had been around in the 1870s, would have been covered with the stuff, and probably would have involved a blue tarp somewhere in the upper works, too. The boat, with its strange, saucer-shallow hull, went into the water, and the steamboatmen watched. Confidently, they waited for it to fill and sink. It floated like a water skipper. Confidently, they predicted it would never make headway against the current. Scott rang for steam and left the dock. Soon it was out of sight. Confidently, they predicted it would never make it back. You have to wonder if any of the other steamboatmen started having second thoughts at this point. Could it be that this ignoramus from back east actually knew what he was doing? If any of them harbored this secret question, he got an answer a week or so later. The Ohio had steamed 185 miles up the Willamette River to Eugene City, taken on 70 tons of wheat, and brought it back to Portland, making a killing. Suddenly, nobody was laughing anymore. The secret of the Ohio's success was that wide, flat, ugly hull. It could float on 9 inches of water when it was empty, and with 100 tons of wheat on board, 18. There were stories of boys out wading in the river having to be shooed out of the way so the ugly little thing could get through. The other steamboat companies considered their designs shallow draft too, but they were water hogs compared with the Ohio. No other boat on the river could get within 40 miles of Eugene City when empty, to say nothing of getting back downstream with cargo. Scott's next boat was the City of Salem, which was a gorgeously appointed, elegant river boat, as unlike the Ohio as a pheasant is unlike a starling. Except, of course, for its draft, which was even shallower than the Ohio. Scott liked to claim it could run on, quote, a heavy dew. He demonstrated this by paying a call at Jefferson, well up the Sandy Am River where no steamer had ever gone, crossing easily through shallows that would stop many rowboats. Caught utterly flat-footed, the two big steamboat companies that had, until that moment, enjoyed a total duopoly on the rivers, scrambled for their lives. Of course, they got busy building their own shallow-draft craft, but the only man in the state who really knew how to do that was now working for himself, so it took them a while to solve the engineering issues. Of course, they tried to buy Scott out. It must have been rather satisfying to Scott to have the same guys who'd blown him off when he asked for a job and laughed at him when he was building the Ohio now coming to him with their hats in their hands. But the time for that sort of thing was long past, and Scott was now in a position to raise all the capital he'd ever need. A third steamboat company had been born. That's all I've got for you today. You can read any archive column and subscribe to either daily feed by going to the website at offbeatoregon.com. Both of the feeds are optimized for smartphone use, but they work great on a tablet or a netbook or even an old-fashioned computer. All the columns are covered by a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license. Thanks for listening, and do drop me a line if you're ever in Corvallis and have time for a cup of coffee. I'm at finn@offbeatoregon.com, or if you do Twitter, @offbeatoregon. Thanks, and have a great day.